He is Robin Leach. He is Jada Markin.
This is Car Keys.
Good morning to our listeners for this week's show, Car Keys. Jada Markin is on with me, Robin Leach, and we will start out, or I will start out the show while talking about what the news in the automotive world is seeing as far as what people want to do about purchasing cars. The headline in one of my periodicals that I get weekly of last week was the following. People are wanting to buy cars, lower grade cars. Cars with low price are in hot demand. This is not an earth-shaking thought to come across the automotive industry, because car prices, as we have said on many of our shows, have been going up rather steadily over the past 3 years. The average price of new cars, I believe, is in the mid-40s, although I saw one headline saying that car sales, or the average price of car sales in December of last year, had reached just about $50,000. Jay may have something to add to this, but I won't let him talk yet. The trend towards lower-priced cars is not surprising, given the rise in interest rates for car financing and other things that are going into these cars, into all cars of all grade levels in terms of technology upgrades, technology content going up, and the like. But the interesting thing about the cars that are in the lower price range is that the automotive makers have been building these cars with a lot of technology and technological features that used to be limited to the upper level cars in the Mercedes, Audi, BMW, Cadillac, Lincoln levels of cars. And now they're trickling down into the Corollas, the Fortes, that's a Kia, below the, and then the Elantra, which is below the Sonata, et cetera. Actually, if you do not have a family of 2 to 4 kids, and do a lot of trip driving, which requires larger vehicles to hold all the luggage and the things that go along when you set out on a vehicle, small cars may be a really smart purchase option for many people who have been wanting to buy upper-grade cars over time. Their interiors have gotten much better in terms of quality of finish. As I said a few minutes ago, or a few words ago, the technology in the cars in the lower price grades often matches much of the technology in the upper price level cars, which means you get backup cameras, you get side view technology for side mirrors, you have cross detection technology in the rear view mirror, backup, and the like. So the problem with these lower-priced cars is there's not much profit in them for either the manufacturers building these cars with upper-grade interiors and technology, and the dealers which sell them. But their sticker prices are in many cases starting in the 20s, mid-20s in some places, low 30s, and can readily be purchased below $40,000. With much of the technology that you used to have to pay $50,000 or $60,000 or $70,000 and up for. Jay, you want to comment?
Well, it goes back to shopping for cars, right? And whether you buy a used car, a new car, if you're on a budget, whether you self-imposed budget or just the reality facts of life, and cannot or won't spend $50,000 and up for a car. The first choice you make is whether you want a used car, a new car. And the new cars, yeah, there are a bunch of very affordable cars. I had drawn up a list a few weeks ago, and I don't even remember if we talked about it or not. But Subaru has Impreza models that are pretty bare bones. But like you said, they still have the features that were found only on much higher priced cars even a decade ago. Which brings me back to all always the same thing. If you're going to buy a car, buy the newest car you can afford. If you're buying a used car, buy the newest car you can afford. The safety features have gotten way, way better than they ever were, both as far as the chassis of the car and how rigid the car is, and also of course all the tech accessories. And I don't have a list up on the top of my head, but you can find a bunch of cars in under $30,000. Even though, like you mentioned, the median price of a car, I think, is up to mid to upper 40s. And I was actually just looking at a list of affordable sports cars right now, and the first car on the list was a $50,000 Honda Civic, and you go or Acura Integra, and you go, that's not really, quote unquote, affordable. But then again, everything is relative.
I agree. You mentioned used cars as well as new cars. The one thing that I would caution anybody looking at used cars to watch out for when they are inspecting the cars that they might be interested in buying is that, dealers are just magicians at making interiors, exteriors, and the like. Everything you can see outside as you walk around the car and inside the cabin as you get in and take a drive almost makes it look brand new. What you don't see and what you should look for, or at least if you have the car inspected by an independent service agency, which might be advisable in many cases, is what is going on underneath where you cannot look at the car, which is basically the underbody, where the brake lines are, the chassis is, and the like, because these used cars, when Jay and I drive many miles as we do during the course of our year, we often see car carriers carrying carrier full trailers of used cars. And you don't know where they're coming from, and you don't know where they're going to, but they seem to get moved around the country. Just great numbers as they go from one market from whence they came to another market from where they ended up getting on the tractor from an auction or wherever they've been bought from. And some of them may be coming from salt-laden states that these cars have been driven in the wintertime and where lots of salt and road melting materials, snow melting materials and ice melting materials are used. And you do, that is the one thing that I found out in one of my vehicles that I bought in the last century and sold in the last century, because it was declared to be rusting away on me, although the body of outside and the interior inside looked not brand new, because I don't keep it that way, but in fine condition and would go for many more years. But the frame was rusted, the brake lines were corroded, and the amount of money that I was told that it was going to take to bring all those areas back to functional, usable conditions for years beyond where they told me it was right when I was having it looked at, was enough to make you want to go out and get a new car. And that's what I did, and I got my first Jeep, and that was back in 2014.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history, right, exactly. So, used cars versus new cars, when you're looking for the best car that you can afford that you may need to be able to keep for 5 years or longer.
Well, I think when buying a used car, if you're searching for a car, you're absolutely right. You want to try to find a car, and it's easy to find. You want to see the Carfax report on the car you're buying, and that Carfax report will give you a lot of information, and most importantly, where the car has been driven over its lifetime. And if I'm looking at cars, I'm looking for cars in down south. That's where the nicest cars are going to come from. They're not always the cheapest, and there's good reason for them not to be cheaper than the cars up here. But the last thing you want to buy, in my mind, is a Subaru that spent all of its lifetime up in Vermont. But then again, you don't even have to go that far. I mean, just look at our roads. I was driving back last night from New York, and I got around here, and I couldn't tell if it was snow on the roads or if we had salt on the roads. And, you know, the amount of salt on our roads is just insane.
Agree.
You know, yes, if you're buying a used car, try to find a car that hasn't lived around here. And on the other hand, you know, I look at the four cars I own now, or the four vehicles, and all four of them are used vehicles. One of them I searched out and took a long time to find, and I ended up buying the vehicle in Georgia, and it had never left Georgia. So, you know, and it was only a year old, so it's not all that important. Although, you know, if you buy a year-old vehicle and it's spent a year in Vermont, and I keep saying Vermont, it's upstate New York or just our neck of the woods.
Michigan.
And it never has been washed, you know, down the line, it will start rusting. I think we've covered that.
We've covered that, Jay, but I'd like to say that talking about the roads, I drove up from Fairfield County, Connecticut this morning before we're doing this show, and you're right, the roads are white. I could not tell, in some cases, whether that was snow and ice on the roads or whether it was just some dried salt. To that point, you should go to a car wash and make sure you get the level of wash that offers an undercarriage wash part option. Some of the cheapest washes do not offer you undercar washes, jets that spray water underneath the cars as you drive slowly into the car wash. And I took my one of my Cherokees, which I came down from Vermont over the weekend was so white, I was just worried about exactly what we've been talking about the underbodies of cars. And I went through the car wash around here, and it did a nice job. But let me tell you, the water droplets dried on the outside of the car. I don't know whether car washes sometimes use recycled water. Water is expensive, and these car washes are using a lot of water. And I don't know whether the recycled water that was sprayed out of the nozzles had salt in them or whether it was just salt that picked up as I drove away from the car wash yesterday. Even though the roads are dry, the wet tires pick up stuff, and you don't know where it's throwing those droplets off the car. But I still have white dots around on the outside of the paint of the Cherokee that I got washed. But I think the undercarriage is pretty salt-free.
So speaking of your Jeep world, what do you know about Stellantis' plans for electrification, which are finally coming to market, I guess, sometime this year or next? What do you know about their large vehicle electric platform, and what vehicles are going to be running on that platform?
Well, you know, I discussed with you, and you didn't know much about it at the time, about what the Ram Charger, or the Ram pickup truck line, is doing to counter the problems with the all-electric versions of pickup trucks that Ford and Chevy have been encountering. And to that end, the sales of the Ford Lightning have fallen off a lot from the beginning era when there was a wait list for it. Chevy has delayed production of the Silverado all-electric truck, and Ram is touting the fact that they're going to have a gasoline generator coupled with an electric drivetrain, but they're going to have a gasoline motor. It's basically going to be a generator that's going to be charging the batteries to power the truck electrically, so that people who use pickup trucks for actually heavy-duty hauling and loads are not going to have the same range anxiety that the all-electric pickups have graphically shown to be a problem with going anywhere in distance when they are doing a heavy-duty pickup truck use. But back to Stellantis and other areas, I've been waiting for Stellantis to come out with a successor to the Jeep Cherokee, which production of which stopped in 2023, and with no announced plans for a replacement vehicle. One of the great Japanese cars, the Toyota 4Runner, I'm not 4Runner, the what's the small crossover that is now a plug-in hybrid, and the hybrid as well as gasoline I thought Stellantis would bring out a new Cherokee with a combination electric hybrid drivetrain. I think the hybrid and one of the things is to your point, Jay, on in general for the industry besides Stellantis, is a headline that says Mazda tap EV breaks outlines its 2030 lineup. Gasoline models power record sales in the U.S. Toyota has seen this too. Well, Toyota's got the best hybrid line across its entire vehicle lineup in the U.S. But I'm getting away from your question to me, which was Stellantis. I don't have a lot to give you on that.
No, I came across I came across some information, and I can't find it. But anyway, I think that the Jeep Wagoneer is coming out, I guess, which is a big SUV, right, is coming out.
Yes, and they've got the full E version of that, and it's advertised heavily on the TV, I've noticed, along with the Wrangler hybrid EV. 4XE, I think they have their models. And I think the sales of that Grand Wagoneer, which is, as you just said, a large SUV, I don't know whether it's gotten to the Grand Wagoneer yet, but the Grand Cherokee has got a 4XE version. I believe it's a plug-in hybrid as well as maybe just a hybrid. That's where they seem to be emphasizing their electric/hybrid engineering in the vehicle lineup that they've currently got out available through their network of vehicles, which is basically the Wrangler 4XE and the Grand Cherokee 4XE. But it hasn't really gotten to the Ram pickup truck yet. And I think the Ram, what did I call it, Jay? Ram Charger or something is this one which is going to have the generator powering the batteries as you drive, as opposed to driving the vehicle, which will be an interesting thing to see.
Yeah, I was thinking about you too. You know, as we talk about electrification and infrastructure and the network of charging stations.
Yeah, there's been a lot about it today in this cold weather.
Anxiety when it comes to finding charging stations. It seems that Tesla is winning another battle with their North American Charging Standard, the NACS,
correct,
which most manufacturers, if not all, have signed agreements with Tesla and are implementing that their charging ports will be Tesla compatible, or actually NACS, North American Charging right. Standard, starting mostly in 2025. And the Hyundai Group, Kia, Genesis, and Hyundai, starting, I think, even in sometime in 2024. So, you know, within the next few years, it seems that Tesla's charging port will become the standard.
The standard.
A little like, remember when we started having unleaded gasoline back in the 70s and we started having these little nozzles and we couldn't put the leaded gasoline in the unleaded cars? You remember that. Most people don't anymore, but we do. And we've had small nozzles ever since with lesser pumping speed than we had back in the 70s. But anyway, so even Electrify America, which is VW's network of or financed by VW, the big charging network will go with Tesla charging ports starting in 2025.
I don't know, Jay, whether they're going to have to retrofit all these non-Tesla charging stations that are popping up even as we are talking. It is, you know, this is the kind of thing that should have been, this is like the old VHS Super 8 tapes and all that kind of thing that was going on and way longer than many people who are listening will ever remember or don't remember or will never remember. But let me transition to the cold weather situation, which is becoming a very big learning curve for people with electric cars. And it's actually made the news in both TV and radio and comment and stories about the problem which you dismissed as being not a real problem because of your experience and knowledge of electric use in electric cars. But there was a TV story recently with a person who was stranded in his electric car in Chicago or something and he was griping about how quickly the battery reserves disappeared or were used up in his electric car. And he said, there's no way to get somebody to come and help you charge your car when you're stranded on the highway in a snowstorm, stuck, and the car battery basically goes dead. There's a learning curve going on, Jay, that I think we mentioned briefly in a recent show about the reality of what electric car limitations are going to be for a while yet before they get some of problems worked out in terms of battery charging in cold weather. Don't leave your cars outside in 0-degree weather. I was in Vermont over this recent weekend, and it was -2 on one morning of the weekend and 0 much of the rest of the day and 2 above the rest of the day. And I could only think that electric cars were not very happy when they were at ski areas where they don't have garages at their condominiums the people drive at.
And, I don't think it's all that much of a doom and gloom situation.
You tell that to the owner that has the problem in any given morning with that situation, and they won't agree that it's not much doom and gloom, that there's not much doom and gloom that we should accentuate on this, but it is going to be a problem in cold states. And also hot states. I heard that the ideal temperature for batteries is somewhere in the 70-degree range for operational efficiency. I don't know whether you are aware of that.
ICE engines, internal combustion engines don't do very well in extreme heat, nor do they do very well in extreme cold either.
And, yeah, but they run, and you get the same mileage.
Sometimes they don't even start.
I will beg to differ with you. That's a battery problem, condition problem, not a cold weather problem. Because cars today are using synthetic oil, and synthetic oil does not get gluey like the old oil used to. The Jeep Cherokee that I bought in 2014's cold weather package came with a plug-in block heater. No longer are the plug-in block heaters part of the cold weather packages in Stellantis vehicles that I know of that are still going, because the synthetic oil takes that problem and puts it out of it being a problem. And I can tell you that my Cherokee started at 2 below as if there was no problem with the oil viscosity, so to speak, which would have made an older car hard to start. Enough said. Your time, Jay. What do you want to talk about?
Oh, I've been chiming in on what you have to say. So
no, that's fine. I don't find combustion cars having a problem in cold weather anymore if it's new and uses synthetic oil and has a good battery.
All right. Well, we have 10 years to keep buying internal combustion engine cars.
At least, and maybe longer, because Toyota's talking about keeping combustion engines in service for a longer period of time than once was expected, although the states may limit the ability to sell them. As you would say, because California wants to be all electric by 2030 or 2035, and where California goes, other states will follow.
So, what's the next car you're going to buy?
I'm not going to buy. I don't have a car purchase plan in my radar anytime soon, and I'm not discarding any of my combustion engine vehicles, other than what a couple of them I want to sell because I don't need them anymore. And I'm going to be driving a combustion engine car probably for the end of my life, if not several of them. What do you say, Jay?
I say I'll keep driving. I mean, who am I to speak? I mean, I don't have an electric car, so I don't really know what I'm talking about, right? I mean, we like our internal combustion engines, and I keep saying that if you have at least two vehicles, which you and I both have, we should have at least one electric vehicle. But I'm not even in that group. So, like I said, who am I to say? I just know that electric vehicles are coming our way, and I do think they're getting the using them is becoming easier every year.
It is. I agree. It's
so,
becoming easier.
You know,
and
there's no point in riding the tide.
There's no question there's going to be more electric cars.
And by the way,
the
they're fast. You know, they're much faster than.
Yes, but you know, I haven't seen anybody fly by
car. I like going fast.
Yeah, but you can't go any faster in an electric car on most of the roads we drive when you're in, let's say, commuting mode.
Totally agree with that. Oh, by the way, do you know that there are speed cameras now in New York City?
I heard that was the case. And they're also talking about putting speed cameras at the yellow lights and getting people going through yellow lights, more speed cameras. And that may be part of what you're telling me about what's going on in New York.
No, they're enforcing 25-mile-an-hour zones in the city. And you know what? They're absolutely right. And we should have that here, too. And it's
they do that in Europe, right? You've been talking about that on several of our shows.
I'm a great fan of that.
Fan of it. Yeah, I agree.
I hate to admit it, and I'm admitting it publicly, obviously, but if you're going to enforce speed, then make it equitable and efficient. That's my thought. And slowing down traffic in congested areas does work. I was driving on 684 last night. I went down to New York and back, and I was kind of in a mellow mood, and I had plenty of time, so I decided not to try to outsmart everybody on the road, and took my time and mostly stuck to one lane, and realized that, you know, there is a flow of traffic and a good and an ideal speed, and I do think that when traffic is really heavy, we should have adaptive speed limits, like they have in Germany. They have unlimited speeds on certain sections of highways, and they bring those down to 100 k, so 60 miles an hour, when traffic or weather conditions dictate the need for that. Speaking of adapting speed to weather conditions, at this time of year, we all see, or I do anyway, see a lot of videos of dash cams of massive crashes on highways. And they invariably start with an idiot, trying to pass everybody and all of a sudden losing control of the vehicle, and then cars start bouncing left and right off guardrails or into the weeds, and a tractor-trailer comes at full speed and starts, you know, and then you start having a pileup. And it's really, really scary. So bring the speeds down on the highways when the weather conditions are less than ideal.
Well, to your 684 experience, I too drive 684 a lot on many days of the week, and they have these signs, you know, overhead warning, flashing anything from missing people in a certain kind of car, look for the car or license plate number, to weather conditions, or exactly slow, go slow, it's slippery conditions in effect. It's amazing how many people ignore it and try to continue along these roads, 684 we're talking about in this particular instance, as I noticed on a recent trip down in which I was going 72 and people were flying by me at anything above 75, despite the fact that it was raining, and there was some of the raindrops that splattered on my windshield showed signs of coming down as partially sleet. It may not, you know, nobody knows when it's going to actually affect the actual surface of the drive of the highway that you're driving on. And it scared me watching some of the cars ignore the weather conditions that were in effect in this particular afternoon when I was going south on 684. So, I caution our listeners to pay good attention to
And that was our tip of the day.
That's our tip of the day, yeah.
And we will see everybody next week.